My name is Stephanie Rieger. This session is on men and women, intimate strangers. The first thing I want to do is tell you that I stole the title from a book which unfortunately I did not order for the bookstore, but I think you can get at home fairly easily in any big bookstore. This book is out in paperback. It's a book by a woman named Lillian Rubin. And it's about relationships between men and women and why they're so difficult. I originally was going to subtitle this talk, Why Men Don't Talk. The reason I was going to subtitle it that is because, well, for one thing, that's the most frequent complaint that psychotherapists hear in, for example, couples counseling. The couples come to couples counseling because the wife is fed up because the husband doesn't talk. Okay? Lots of women complain that it's difficult to get men to speak about their emotions, talk about how they feel about things, to share what they're feeling. The reason I didn't title the talk that is because I think people assume from that title that somehow the problems in the relationship are the man's problem. And I don't believe that at all. I think difficulties in relationships occur because of the interaction between the two people. And what I want to talk about tonight are some of the patterns of child development that lead to some predictable difficulties in relationships between men and women that make intimacy, by which I'm talking now about sharing emotions, sharing feelings, being open with each other, that make that very difficult. And ladies, I'm not going to let you off the hook either. I'm going to talk about why you do talk. both sides are going to be mentioned. And I'm also going to spend a lot of time talking about early childhood development. So I'm going to be spending the next few minutes on men and women when they are at the ages between 18 and about 18 months. Anybody who came here thinking I would be talking about something different is free to leave now. What I'm going to share with you are some current theories. They've come from psychologists who have been thinking about men and women, and I present them as theories because the data, as we say, the studies are really not in yet to know if these theories are strongly supported or not. These theories are particularly difficult ones to test because the ideas are pretty complicated, as you'll see in a few minutes. But they come from psychoanalytic theory, but they're not what we think of as classic Freudian theory, those of you who took introductory psychology in college. There are some assumptions I'm going to be starting with that I will lay out for you that some of them come from psychoanalytic theory and some of them don't. The first one, assumption, is that there is such a thing as the unconscious mind. The unconscious mind is the part of our mind, as one person described it, the terrain of fear and desire. I think that's such a wonderful phrase, fear and desire. The impulses we have that are not acceptable to our conscious mind, we keep down there in the unconscious. We assume that there's an unconscious mind and that there are things that motivate us that we may not be totally aware of at present, but that can be accessible to us. We can make conscious. The second assumption I'm making is that the early years of life are very important for adult behavior. The theorists I'm going to be talking about shortly put an emphasis on the very early infancy stage. Freud himself thought that the development of male and female identity occurred around the Oedipal phase, when kids were between 4 and 5 years old. I have a son who's 3 and a half. I'm looking forward to the Oedipal stage when he thinks I'm terrific and only wants to be with me, etc. A lot of research since then puts the development of a sense of masculinity and femininity much earlier. Kids by the age of 3 know if they're male or female. If you ask them, are you a boy or a girl, they will be able to say. some of the most interesting research on this comes from people who've been born with physical abnormalities such that they have some sex characteristics of both sexes. I won't get into descriptions of this. This is a very rare phenomenon, but they're known as hermaphrodites. And there's a man named John Money at Johns Hopkins University who's done a lot of research with them. And what he finds is that these kids, like any children, like all children, are assigned a gender at birth. By that I mean somebody looks at the infant and says, it's a boy or it's a girl. In some cases, the biological sex is stronger towards the gender that they have not been assigned. Excuse me, and Money finds that after the age of 3, it's much easier to change them biologically than it is to change that gender assignment. It's practically impossible to change that gender assignment after the age of 3. So, somewhat off the subject, but an interesting fact nonetheless. For that reason, we argue that a sense of male or female, a very crude sense of male or femaleness, is developed at a very early age in kids. That's the second assumption I'm making. And the third assumption I'm making is that we all carry around within us some of the emotional states that we had when we were children. We don't always show those, we don't always experience those, but sometimes something sets off a button and we will be right back there at age 5. I don't mean we remember what it was like to be age 5, I mean we really re-experience those feelings. I'll give you an example from my own life of something I talked about last week when I was talking about anger. I gave an example of taking a lamp into a lamp store. They said it would be done in a week. I came back a week later and I called them and they said, it's not ready yet, it'll be done in a week. I called them a week later and said, it's not ready yet, it'll be done in a week. This went on for 3 months. I became more and more enraged. I just became furious. And as I confessed to the group last week, I found myself swearing because every obscenity I knew, which is not too many, but everyone I could come up with, at the very nice woman who answered the phone on the other end, telling me my lamp wasn't ready. I thought about that a lot, about what made me so angry. And the thing that was making me so angry in that situation was that I felt I was being lied to deliberately, week after week after week. And that sets off one of my buttons. It's a fairly trivial button, but, excuse me, obviously it was an important one. When I was a kid, my mother would come into my bedroom and wake me up, and I would say, what time is it? And she would say, oh, it's 7:45. I would fly out of bed, I was gonna be late. I would really rush to get dressed. I would run to the kitchen. I would sit down, ready to eat, and I would look at the clock. It was just 7:40. My mother had told me 15 minutes later than it actually was. And this happened week after week, day after day, and it always got me furious. When I was a child, I felt helpless to do anything. Even though I protested, my mother thought it was a good way to get me ready on time. Now, none of you will never do this to your kids. And you can see I always wear a watch, so it's not going to happen to me again. But when the woman in the lamp was talking to me, I was re-experiencing that sense of helpless rage that I felt when I was a child. So when I talk about going back to those feelings, I don't mean I remembered what it was like. This realization came to me only later. I mean that I really re-experienced those feelings. Okay. Given that background, let me talk about what Lillian Rubin presents in this book and what some people are thinking about male and female identity, why that's different, why male and female development is different, and why that sets the stage for difficulties in relationships later in life. First, let me ask you if there are any questions up to this point so I can take a sip of coffee. Any questions or comments? Okay, folks. Okay. First of all, I'm talking about the average family. Many people don't come from the average family, so this does not apply to everybody. I'm also talking pretty much about the average traditional family in which child rearing is mostly the responsibility of the woman, of mother. What happens when a son is born to a woman is that she feels a great sense of identity with the infant. One of the most powerful feelings I ever had in my life was in the hours after my son was born. I felt a tremendous sense of identification with him to the point where I did not know, and I couldn't tell you for a long time afterwards, where I stopped and he began. Do other women in the room share that? Is that something that happened to other people, or am I just... I got one or two heads nodding yes, so, okay. I felt that very, very powerfully. I remember lying on my bed, looking at him lying in his little bassinet, or whatever they call them in the hospital, and I was lying in the same position he was in, and I felt that I was him and he was me. And it was an overwhelming sense of identification with this little infant, this little purple thing that had suddenly appeared. That was my comment when he was purple. I was startled. I didn't know a lot about infants then. I know more now. Okay. If the child is a boy, one of the things that happens is that there's a sense of difference between the mother and the son. There's a sense of differentness of separation. The argument in this theory is that boys are encouraged to develop an independent sense of themselves much more than girls are. Individuation is the term that some people use to describe that. They're encouraged to develop a sense of self-esteem that comes from within themselves. And independence is a theme that we see a lot of in male development. Girls, on the other hand, the mother can identify with the girl more closely, doesn't have to break that, and the girl doesn't have to break the connection with mother to develop a sense of herself as female. The boy, at some point in growing up, has to break with mother, has to rebel against her, has to separate from her, has to see himself as different in order to develop a sense of himself as male. So in the language that this theory talks about, the ego boundaries, the boundaries of the self, are much more strongly defined for the boy than they are for the girl. The girl's development centers around, and again this is traditional development and it doesn't apply to everybody, but it centers around connectedness. She's connected to mother, she's like mother, she has the same body as mother. Mother identifies with her, doesn't push her out the way she pushes the boy out. So the themes in her development are connections. So what happens when these little two kids grow up, the little boy and the little girl? The little boy grows up with a strong sense of self, a strong sense of independence, a strong sense of who he is. He also might grow up, and this is where I think the theory gets a little more speculative, with a fear, an unconscious fear, of going back to that childhood state when he was dominated by somebody who, in his eyes, was an all-powerful mother. A mother who was much stronger than him, who was more powerful than him, and with respect to whom he was helpless. He was totally dependent, he was totally helpless. So for him, in some ways, being close to a woman may set off those buttons that say helplessness, total dependence, etc. So the thought of loosening those boundaries of the self and sharing and becoming intimate can be something that is very frightening to males. We have a lot of males in the room. I think some of you disagree, so we can get a discussion about this. The female, on the other hand, so let me just finish up with male development. He has a strong sense of who he is. Some of his difficulties may arise around sharing that sense of who he is, because that can be threatening to him. The females, on the other hand, look for connection. because they had such a satisfying experience of connection early on in life, connection with mother. For them, sharing is the easy thing to do. And caring and all nurturing, all those things that flow out of that relationship. The difficulties that I see in women are the lack of a sense of boundary, a sense of individuality, a sense of differentness. So I see women who come to therapists and talk about not knowing who they are, not knowing what they want, not knowing what they need, having a very difficult time setting boundaries, saying to somebody, no, I don't want to run that rummage sale for you, because they should be all caring and all connecting and nurture the world, etc. So what happens when these two people grow up is that the woman says, I want connection, I want intimacy. And the male says, wait a minute, don't get too close, because you're setting off all those buttons that remind me of that all-powerful mom that I had. Are you with me so far? You are with me. So you may disagree with me, but so far you're with me. Okay. So what we see over and over again is a pattern that develops, a pattern of the woman seeking closeness, getting more and more frustrated, and therefore louder in her demands for intimacy and closeness. The louder she gets, the more fearful, the more of those buttons may be set off in the male, and the more the male may say, stay away, I need my distance. This is something that's really hard for me. That's what it may look like underneath. On the surface, it may look like something else. I don't know. You can make up the examples as well as I can. But that may be what's going on underneath. And that's why early childhood development can lead to lots of difficulties in intimacy between men and women. Let me stop at this point and get some of your reactions and comments and disagreement, whatever.
Just a question here. What you're saying, that syndrome, you said that was what was underneath, but that may not be what's on the surface. Did you mean just the other way around? That's what it is. Or is that the real underlying? Are you saying that that's the real underlying rationale for why a man distances himself?
I would say in a lot of cases,
tries to.
That may be some of the things that are going on underneath. Are you disagreeing, or is your experience been different? Or what?
Well, I mean, what's the difference between the underneath and then the surface, in that sense? What would appear to be on the surface? If that's the underneath, what's the surface?
Okay, the surface might be, and you men will forgive me, or you'll disagree with me, unfair. Somebody who's very rational. So just tell me what you want, and I'll try and do it. When what the woman is asking for is not a rational response, but an emotional intimacy, a sense of emotional intimacy. That's what I meant by
that. As fathers change their roles in child rearing, what happens?
I think a lot of wonderful things happen. And I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the reasons I'm talking about that tomorrow night. I didn't, I promise, set you up. But I think one of the things that happens is partly the little boy gets some role model of some caring, loving man. So he's got somebody to identify with real closely. And that all-powerful mother is sort of broken up. She's less powerful.
Does it also give the daughter a more of an independent
I think
identity?
Absolutely it does. I think it does, because she's getting from father encouragement to be independent and separated and all those good things. I think it's great for both kids, and I think it's great for fathers. So I think everybody wins when there's a really strong emotional involvement on the part of fathers. There's some research that I read that I was astounded by, so I went back and read it again, on the amount of time the typical American father spends with the child when he's not doing something else. What we mean when we say quality time. I hate that term, but that's what people are talking about. When you're spending time really focusing on the kid, and not when you're watching baseball with the kid or having dinner with the kid or whatever, how many minutes a day do you think the average father spends with the kid in that kind of time?
Three.
It's really, really small.
It is.
think I wrote that same thing. It's like three or four minutes.
Two minutes.
And how much is the mother giving? What's the, just to give a balance here?
Good question. They didn't study that. They didn't study that. The implication was that it was a lot more time, but maybe not.
I mean, there's a lot of just housekeeping chores that are going on in family relationships, which you are watching television, or you are just doing something together, but you aren't interacting together.
So that time wouldn't count, and we really ought to do that study. We're going to shout about 2 minutes for men and voluntarily.
I'm sure that it's more of a women, assuming that.
Double at least.
Well, I'm on a 23-day trek with myself and my two kids, 5 and 3. And my daughter's 3 and my son's 5, and I was real fascinated with what you were saying, because I've noticed, as I've been spending all the time with them, that my daughter has tended to, you know, cling a lot. And I have been saying things to her like, Bryn, Bryn, you need to be more independent. And my son, on the other hand, you know, who has been very independent, I felt very good when he has come and wanted hugs and has felt like he needs some nurturing. And so what's happening is that I'm almost, I mean, when you said this, it blew my mind, because I thought, I'm kind of doing the opposite thing. I'm kind of doing to Eric, but probably, and I'm not around, well, I'm around my children an awful lot, so I can't say that, but maybe that, you know, I'm doing just the opposite thing. I don't know.
Well, I think what you're doing is balancing, perhaps, some of the things they may be getting elsewhere.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what she said.
Next week's session. Is this a pattern that's holding truth that you see? Okay. I'll give you a real short answer, and the short answer is that it's a long, complicated process for women of developing that sense of self. What I mean by that is developing an internal sense of self-esteem, developing a voice in your head that says, I'm worthy, I deserve some space of my own, I don't have to be nurturing to everybody in order to feel good, etc. Developing an independent sense of self, of who you are, what you need, and then learning how to take care of yourself. Self-care is a term that I use a lot, which I don't mean brushing your teeth. I mean learning what you need emotionally and how to get it. That's what females need. Males, on the other hand, since you asked me, I can tell males what they need. need to look at the fears, the difficulties, etc., and start doing some work on that. Trusting, vulnerability, all of those, should I use the expression, touchy-feely things? Sort of a put-down expression, but I really mean them very seriously, because I think that we're going to continue the cycle of difficulties in relationships until we start to learn how to talk to each other. And that's fundamentally what I'm suggesting are some reasons why it's so difficult to talk.
You mentioned that boys need to be with mother and girl. I think you the term you used. What is the typical age for that to occur at?
I think it occurred, it looks different in different ages.
I realize that that's a possibility, but a couple other times you mentioned relative age, you know, like about 5 for the Oedipus complex, and there were a couple other things that you were more specific in.
I think it looks, I'm repeating myself, but a 3-year-old rebelling, I mean, I can give lots of examples of my son saying, I hate you, mommy, I hate you, daddy. He also says, I love you, mommy, I love you, daddy. But that's what it looks like at 3. At 13, we probably have other examples, things I get to look forward to. Those sorts of, that's what I mean when I say
it looks sort of continuous.
I think in some ways, It is. Some of you who have older children can speak to this more directly. See, I worry about kids who never rebel. I worry about kids who are too good, who are always behaving, who always follow the rules, who always do everything they should. I worry about those kids. For one thing, and girls, those are, let me phrase this carefully. Girls who have eating disorders frequently show that pattern of behavior. They're just too good. They're controlling everything, including their bodies, and it's coming out in symptoms like that. Not all girls who are good. And I'm also not saying that kids should go off. What's the worst thing my son can do? What am I most afraid of? Take serious drugs. That scares me because it's hard to get off of that. I'm not advocating that. The kids who always obey, I think there's a lot there that they're not letting out. And I think they're going to have a real hard time separating themselves emotionally from their parents. How do you feel, those of you at whatever age you are, when you go to visit your parents? Do you all of a sudden find yourself, maybe 40 or 50 or 60, however old you are, back in your 8-year-old role or your 10-year-old role? Okay. That's what I mean by separating from your parents and the need to rebel some and get some distance on that. The good thing that I think comes out of that is the opportunity for adult children and parents to be friends. And I think that's wonderful. I'm hoping someday my parents and I get to that state, but we're working on it.
But you're talking about these models or stereotypes of how a woman responds, how a man responds, and your wives. Mm-hmm. How does a couple work towards breaking this down and getting rid of or breaking out of the stereotype mold to change the behavior pattern or to change the feeling level or expression level or whatever it is as a couple?
I think there's a number of things you can do. First of all, you can start looking very hard and very honestly at the patterns you see going on in your relationships. I think awareness is the first step. And once you're aware of them, then you can start to talk about them, and then you can start to change them. Is that too general an answer? I don't know.
Just for myself to realize that if I'm distant, mm-hmm. and that's the reason for it, mm-hmm. that doesn't really help me on how I'm going to change it. I mean, now I know why I'm the way I am, but how do I mm-hmm. do something about it?
Let me go back to the lamp store. If I had realized then what was going on, which I didn't, it took me a long time to get over that experience of being furious with these people, I could have said to myself, wait a minute, this is my time button. This is my lies about trivial things button. I know that really sets me off. I know that enrages me. And I know what happens to me when that happens. I could have tried to separate all that emotional baggage from what was actually going on, which is that these people didn't want to, in the middle of summer when they had a lot of air conditioning business, fiddle with my cheapo lamp because it just wasn't working for them. And I could have started to negotiate with them about how to do that. I could have separated the emotional baggage from the reality of what was going on. In the same way that once you become aware of these patterns in yourself, you can say, wait a minute, there goes my pattern again. Could give it a name. Oh, here comes Kirby again. Whatever. You know, you could make it into a joke if it's something that goes on between the two of you. That could be a fun way to deal with it. And you could separate that. You could wrench yourself away from that pattern way of responding and start looking at the issues. That sounds real simple to do. In practice, it's very hard to do. I certainly would be the first to say that. It's very hard to do. It takes a lot of risk-taking on your part, because you have to be willing to say very honestly to somebody how you're feeling, and you have to take risks in being open when that may be something that's unfamiliar or scary or whatever. So it takes a lot of commitment to the relationship. It takes a lot of commitment to change all those things.
I was thinking of the problems of thinking of blaming, because that's where the residue, the resentments grow. If you can identify something that's got some roots in something besides your spouse, it kind of helps at least clear, not totally, but it helps make some order there. Where usually if John and I are having an argument, there's a confusion. The purposes are usually what they end up being. This may just be us, but is an attempt. We're each attempting to prove how right we are. And if the other person gets away with proving me wrong, there's a blame thing there, too. See, I've been thinking a lot about self-righteousness in terms of relationships. I think that's a terrible place to live.
And the other thing that goes on, if you think you're right, you don't really listen very hard to his position. Because you know he's not right. You know you are fair and reasonable and open-minded, and you know that he should change, right? So as long as you keep thinking that, what kind of response would you give to somebody who said you should change?
And somebody, anybody, I don't care if it was a teacher when I was 7 or my mother, somebody saying you should change is one of those places that I get most thoughts and thoughts of resistance. I didn't have power to say no then, but now I don't want to just, well, sure, fine, you say so, sure, I'll change.
And that's why, last week when we talked about anger, I talked about the difference between expressing your anger in the form of you should change, you're wrong, you jerk, etc., and I'm having trouble thinking of an example. I get scared when you yell at me and you look ferocious. Okay. I'm really hurt when I saw you talking to that other woman for 2 hours the other day. Okay? That's instead of saying, where were you? Why weren't you home washing the dishes or something like that? Okay? When you talk about I, how I feel and why I feel that way, you open the possibilities, first of all, for the other person to hear you and not just get defensive, but also for a change to occur on their part in the best of all possible world.
There was a hand up over here.
Well, I was just going to, just what you're saying, you know, those were responses that showed learned skills. And I think a lot of times women have experienced a sense of connectedness, yearn for it maybe in a way that men don't, but don't necessarily have the skills anymore that men do to be able to establish the connectedness. And so, you know, it's not just you who has to change. I think couples have to work together and developing the communication patterns that bring connectedness. Like, because a lot of times you just have the yearnings and frustrations, but no better skills than that.
Sure, I think that's true. And I think for women, there's also, it's not that women are terrific at expressing emotions, all emotions either. Anger is the one that I find a lot of women, including myself, have a lot of trouble with. Part of anger is saying, this is who I am, and this is where I stop, and you stay over there, I stay over here. And for a lot of women, drawing that boundary in a lot of different ways is very difficult. It's hard to connect with somebody if they don't have a strong sense of self. So I think women really need to develop that if they're going to have the closeness that they want. It's sort of ironic. And before you can really share a self, you have to have a sense of who you are.
So you could take your risks.
Absolutely. Sure. There's a lot of risk on that side, too.
But sometimes, if you develop a stronger sense of self, it changes the relationship, too.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes negatively.
Always.
I mean, sometimes, your husband may decide he likes you better the other way.
I think think that's a real risk. What else can we say about that? Now we're getting down to some of the costs. Because people are in relationships the way they are because they're getting something out of it. And the relationships stay the way they are because people are getting something out of it. And changing means that the equation's going to be different. And maybe you finally realize who you are, and that's not somebody your husband likes. One of the, or vice versa, one of the most interesting things I heard that stuck in my mind for a long time was a divorce court judge saying that he thought that the reasons people get divorced were exactly the same reasons why people get married. For example, and here are an example of a man again. Men don't mind, you've heard a lot from me already tonight. A young man who at age 20 or 21 marries a woman who is really adoring of him. He's fairly new in the world. He's new in a business or a profession or whatever his job is. He doesn't have a lot of self-confidence. So he really wants somebody to look up to him and boost his ego and say, you're terrific, and take care of him, etc. That same man, 20 years later, may have developed enough success so that he really feels quite confident of himself. And he finds this woman is always looking up to him to be sort of a drag. Well, she's not doing anything except sort of worshiping him, and he's tired of it. He doesn't need that anymore. So he's changed in some ways. The reason he married her in the first place was because she gave him all these sort of compliments and support. And the reason he's going to divorce her, or they are going to get divorced, is because he doesn't need that, and he doesn't find that an important thing that he needs from the outside anymore. So the same reason that led them to get married is the reason that's leading to the divorce. And we could give examples from the female side of that. In fact, that might even be more true of females. I don't know if anybody's done a survey of the reasons for divorce. It'd be an interesting survey. There's certainly a lot of people, a lot of subjects, as we call them, social science research. A woman who, at age 20, feels fairly unsure of herself, wants somebody to take care of her. At age 40, let's say in a traditional marriage, her kids are pretty much out of the house. And she's looking around, she's reading all these newspaper articles about how women are going into the workforce and wearing streaky suits and running shoes and off to work with their briefcases and being lawyers and divorce court judges and all that. And she decides to go out in the world. The average age for women entering the workforce, I should update this. I don't know if this is still true, but a few years ago it was 36. So her kids, if she had kids at 20, her kids are fairly well on into school. She's entering the workforce, and she finds this whole world out there. And she's really excited about it, and after a few years, she gets a lot of self-confidence. And yet she goes home at night, and there's a husband there who expects her to be dependent on him. And there she is, by day arguing before the Supreme Court, at night supposed to be this, let me say this a little bit, but you understand the pattern that I'm talking about, and she doesn't need that anymore. So the hard thing to do, and we can, if you think about this, you can really understand why there's so many divorces, because two people sort of changing at the same rate and having good enough communication and openness to really talk about all these changes and continue to grow together is pretty miraculous. And these days we base marriage a lot on love and satisfaction and things like that, because we could all, most of us, survive, if minimally, economically. And some of the other reasons that held marriage together are not as strong. So.
I'd like to speculate on, I was reading a statistic the other day that said we're finding over 50% mark in terms of divorce. And some sociologists are predicting 66%, and 2/3 of marriages getting divorced as baby boomers moving into the 40s. I'm wondering, but then I've also read this article that America is way ahead of the rest of the world, because Europe doesn't seem to have that high rate. It has a high rate, but not near as high. And some countries, of course, have a very low rate. I'm sure there's traditional reasons for that. Why do you think ours is higher than maybe the rest of the world, which is what the psychologists were saying? We're way above. We're 12 percentage points above the next nation of divorces. Why do you think that's
I think, well, I'll tell you my free association. You're willing to accept them. The first thing that came into my mind is that our country has one of the highest rates of violent crime of any country in the world. I don't know if those two statistics are at all related, but that may say something about the sort of breakup of what we might think of as the moral order, the traditional values or whatever. Another thing that I think of is that there is much less support for families in the United States than there is in a lot of countries. A lot of you are familiar with Scandinavian countries. I think they're much better at supporting families than our country is. I think our country is very tough on families. Not only is it difficult to get paid maternity leave with a guaranteed job once you get back, paid paternity leave is such a wild idea. We can probably count on two hands the companies that let men take time off. Either to take care of a child, an infant, a sick child. What about paid leave to take care of sick parents? That's going to become a big issue, I think, in the next 20 years as we have a larger and larger aging population. I think our country is tough on families in lots of ways. Can other people think of examples or maybe tell us things that come to your mind when we think about divorce? Why the divorce rate is so high here?
I don't think we've equipped our children very well to relate to one another and to women. I mean, I can't speak for the rest of you, but for my age at least, I don't think that I was equipped.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're even less equipped for parenting. There's an interesting discussion about marriage and marriage laws and licensing, whether there should be marriage licenses. Well, I personally don't care if they're marriage licenses. I think there should be parenthood licenses. I can't figure out on what basis I would give them out. But I think some of you may disagree with me vehemently. I think people should go through a number of trial relationships before they're permitted, so they learn how to relate to each other before they're permitted to have children. Because I think kids are really paying the price for that high divorce rate, kids and women.
Can I start you a bit further to ask you, how do you feel about the way the church relates to the family? Do you think the church is supportive, or do you think the church... I'm a pastor, I've moved every 5 years, I'm more like a military person. I was reading an article the other day that said that it was an interesting, same article, I think, that said that basically corporations had a vested interest in the families being broken up because they wanted people that could move fast and quick and didn't have a lot of commitments. And children are commitments. You got school, parents are commitments. So therefore, it was in the interest of corporations not to have divorces. I mean, this person was not saying that they're out there scheming it, but saying that the way the machinery works. And the church also, you know, I worked in the church, and every 5 years you move as a pastor, and we kind of follow the corporate model. But that's a prejudice about the pastors. But what do you think about the church in general? The church is doing good?
I don't know. The first question I would ask is there such a thing as the church?
The ALC.
You have much stronger opinions on this than I do. What do you think?
Stephanie?
I don't know.
From the LCA. And the early Danish church, when I went to get married, my future husband and I went in and we sat down and talked about who was going to walk in when. Who was going to walk in when. That was the kind of counseling that we had prior to getting married.
The person walk into the marriage
walk into the marriage ceremony. The person that did this to us, that we participated in with him, was a fine person, but I think he was just as ill-equipped to try and counsel us about getting married as anybody else. I don't think that education needs to come from the schools particularly, or from only the church, or from only the family, but I think it needs to come from someplace, and it didn't come from the church for me.
I'm a Canadian, so I relate to the Canadian experience, of course, but I'm a pastor in a church just outside of Vancouver, and I think the church has a lot of catching up to do
in terms of women being in the ministry and in terms of maternity leave for women pastors and in terms of my husband taking a paternity leave, I think that there's a law in the books that if a woman is, or a man, sits without call for 3 years, they can have to go through call pay all over again, which really isn't very long if you're, you know, having a young child at home or that kind of thing. So I think they've got a lot of things you have to do.
I think that we've got sentimentality at every level of family, but in the country and the church too, and that it's a sentimental notion, and that we're very hard on children, that churches, I'm just from a very small parish at this time, and I grew up as a part of a very church family, and a pastor, and other things, including Holy Village in my life. And I think that there's always been the expectation that if you're a good Christian person, you're ready to serve anybody's need. It's more of the nurturing, you know, myth. And that pastors were supposed to be as available as mothers were. I think Arnie and Sharon, for me, have been a great example of how to stay in the church and be a married, I think, happy family. But it takes, Arnie, I've heard say, no, I won't do that, and I won't take that kind of call. And I, if you don't mind being exposed since you're new, I think it's one of my pet peeves, because I think as a church we hold up a good Christian family and we destroy lots of pastors' families. So that's the small.
I know this is a topic that's important to a lot of people. But I'm also standing here thinking that what we're conveniently doing, talking about the church outside there, what we started talking about was emotional intimacy between men and women. I think it's a real hard topic to talk about.
Getting back to the original, what question I was going to have is, we talked a lot about the relationship of how mother affects us as boys and girls and women and men, but at least in my own experience, I wonder why then that's so true, that it is men who have the largest influence on, definitely in terms of my having to find self-esteem from outside. I mean, my view of myself comes from how other people see me, and that's been a lot of work to try and change that. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen throughout my life a reflection of how it's been the male figures that have been mostly father, brother, teachers, and I can go on down the line. And women have much, much, much less effect on who I am and what I think about myself. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of confrontation with women. I'm terribly afraid of confrontation with men. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments about that?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I'm going to think about it for a while. My first reaction is that men tend to have more power. So male approval and disapproval, men have more power in society, etc., can be really important. That's a quick reaction. Other people have reactions to that. I think that's a really good question.
Perhaps in a traditional family role, too, although the mother is all-powerful, she's all-powerful in your small realm. And dad is all powerful out there in a bigger home. So it's again the power thing. And maybe it's a hierarchical structure in the family too, where mother answers to dad.
Up until very recently, if you asked little kids, would you rather be a mommy or daddy? Up until very recently, they would say, I'd rather be a daddy. He gets to go out, he gets to travel and to go to work, which is an interesting, exciting place if you haven't been here. It changes. It's automatic.
Does it?
Okay. So for little kids, daddy is a very important figure. Certainly mommy's an important figure too, but mommy's around a lot. She's around all the time. In traditional families, little boys get their notion of what's appropriate for males, not just from their daddy, or not even from the daddy really there 2 minutes a day, but a lot from their peers and a lot from the media. And the image they get of what a male is supposed to be is a very rigid image, a very cut and dried image of a
haven't seen this movie. I hate to mention it because I don't want to give it publicity, but something like the Rambo movies, you know, that sort of tough cartoon-like image. That's what little boys pick up on, and that's what they can see real clearly. So they get this image of powerful figures, which is getting away from this question. Daddy can be seen as a really powerful figure if he's not around all the time.
Bouncing her question back around what you were saying earlier, didn't you state that it was the males who were encouraging independence, trying to get out, be your own person, affirming individualism, or the females are saying, well, I'll come back to the family, you're okay back here, trying to draw you back in, not to affirm self, but to affirm the community.
That isn't what you said, is it?
I don't think so.
What I heard you say was that the independence came because the boy was different, and therefore, as he began to recognize the differences, it forced an independence to grow.
That's part of it, yes.
That the girl didn't experience.
And the girl doesn't get pushed away. I don't mean that pushed away in a rough sense.
Right.
But she's not separated. Mother doesn't sense this difference.
There isn't a natural difference that just develops.
Well, you use the word natural, and I started out by saying this is a traditional family structure. I don't think there's anything necessarily. I don't think there's anything necessarily natural about the traditional family structure. If we had a different family structure, we might see a different psychological pattern in people. So I'm not agreeing with the word natural for that reason.
Would you agree with physical?
Physical in the sense that the little boy is physically different from the mother. Yes. Yes.
I think, going back to her question too, one of the things that I've experienced is the conflict in terms of what is it I seek approval for? And that has been changing for women. And so I find myself not only in conflict because, you know, in my connectedness to my mother, what she taught me in terms of how to get approval both from her and from men was what traditionally pleased men. Mm-hmm. And now I don't get approval from men for taking on some of that power. Now I don't get approval from my mother either because I'm not connected to her anymore, different from her too. And so I think it's real hard for those of us who are kind of caught in the transitional phases.
But in that situation, don't you get reinforcement from somebody? You lose it in one spot and you pick it up in another place.
But I was going to say, I think one of the things too is that whole thing of approval needs are real important, and it's real hard sometimes to give affirmation. And I think learning what it is that I need affirmation for, I don't need affirmation just for looking nice, for cooking nice. I need affirmation in my ability to be angry when it's appropriate, and that's something I'm not used to giving affirmation to women for. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have time for one last comment.
As a woman, it does not have to go through a separation, and is encouraged to keep the connections going. Mm-hmm. And as you're growing up as a child, a lot of your important connections are with your mother, mm-hmm. And other females. The man is still apart because he has learned to be independent. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe part of the thing of trying to win approval, a sense of approval from men, is just trying to connect. It works with, you know, other women. I can connect with other women, but I keep bouncing against a man. And why is that? It's easy with other women, but it isn't with a man. And so this way we learn to interact doesn't work.
If women's roles change and they lose a sense of connectedness and they start going out in the world and become more independent, what's to keep the woman from becoming more distant so that you have distant woman, distant man, no connectedness? It may get worse.
Maybe men will pick up some of the slack.
How?